This is the Edisto TV podcast, connecting the Blackwater region.
Welcome back. Another edition of the Edisto TV podcast. This is episode 10, and we've been doing it weekly so far, so making it to double digits is an accomplishment of some sort. Congratulate yourself, Tom.
Thank you. Congratulations to me and you. Good job.
So here we go with episode 10. This week we've got a phone conversation with Chris Hall from the Sierra Club. Chris lives over in Aiken, and we've gotten to know him through the Edisto River business. So we have begun to speak to him, and this will be the first of what should turn into periodic check-ins to see what's going on in Chris's world and with the Sierra Club, especially in relation to the Edisto and to surface water withdrawal issues in general. Also, we've got several interviews we've done recently that we have bits and pieces of that haven't made it onto the podcast yet. We talked to Vince Furtick a lot about surface water issues, talked a lot with Ben Gregg about that, and also with Bob Guild. All three of them very interesting and very cogent ideas about the topic. And so we want to get that in here, so we're going to edit that together into kind of a conversation about a variety of topics that they all addressed when we were speaking to them, with content that hasn't made it onto the podcast yet. So we're going to include that this week. And Tom, what's up on the internet?
Well, the main thing is just that we got some rain. So the gauges are all indicating a lot more water than there was a couple weeks ago. And we did add on Edisto TV, we have a little block on the front page that has links to the USGS gauges. I know I find myself frequently wanting to go out there and find it, and I usually go to Google, but anyway, if you go to Edisto TV, in the top right corner, you'll see links to the three gauges on Edisto, which are Denmark, Orangeburg, and Gavans Ferry.
And as you said, all three of those gauges now showing a lot more water than they did a week or so ago. And as is the case with rain, you either have too much or not enough of it. And when the little dry spell broke, we actually had reports of flooding in Orangeburg. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there was 8 inches they got one night. And just to tell you how isolated it was, here we are 20, 25 miles from Orangeburg. I got less than an inch that same night. So it's very isolated. It's kind of hit and miss. You don't know where the rain's going to hit.
I do believe, though, that the Times and Democrat, for instance, had some news coverage of the flooding that happened down in Orangeburg. So if folks do want to know more about that, they can go to the TND site and should be able to see all there was from the local media there. So let's move along. We're going to take a brief pause. When we come back, we're going to have the interview with Chris Hall.
For more information and archived podcasts, visit us at edisto.tv.
So, as I said in the introduction, Chris Hall is a guy that we've gotten to know through the Edisto River stuff. He's been to a number of the river events. And we got to talking to him about the role that the Sierra Club has taken in addressing some of the concerns about surface water withdrawal and so forth, and a variety of other issues. Tom, do you want to say anything before we go right into the conversation?
Well, just that the Water Sentinel program, I think, is something that they're trying to get off the ground, that I think a lot of our listeners and people who are concerned about the river would definitely want to participate in. I think the idea is just to get a lot of people looking at the river, measuring and being certified and qualified to report, you know, the status of the river.
All right. Well, with that as introduction, let's jump right into that conversation. We recorded this on Sunday afternoon, the 27th.
My name is Chris Hall, and I'm with the South Carolina Sierra Club. I'm a executive committee member at large, and Sierra Club is the largest grassroots organization in the country, and here in South Carolina, we've been here for a good many years and have had a large range of its success in a variety of conservation-related issues. My role with the Sierra Club is, for the past couple of years, has been fundraising chair, and like every other organization out there, our emphasis for doing work depends upon not only the dollars, obviously, to staff an office as well as, you know, educate the general public, but also we have activists all across the state that get involved in a variety of issues. We We have people showing up for meetings, writing letters to their various representatives. And I guess from the perspective of the Edisto River, we've been involved in a variety of issues on rivers and in Charleston Harbor, for example, where we've been able to harness our membership and, you know, really have a big impact. I've been paddling the Edisto River for better part of about 15 years and, you know, found it to just be an amazing resource. And we're so fortunate to have such a outstanding river here in our communities. My experience has been primarily started paddling through a group, county commission down based out of Carlton County called Edisto River Canoe and Kayak Trail Commission. You can call them ERC for short, E-R-C-K. The ERC group, we do a variety of classes that focus on paddling skills like canoeing as well as kayaking. And we also do some river rescue classes and have really been the primary go-to group to train people in water safety related issues. For example, this past year we've done a group of rangers for the South Carolina State Parks, and we've got another one coming up in September. It's an intensive two-day class that we start off on a Saturday morning. There's some classroom time where we talk about a variety of different issues like first aid, and we'll discuss some paddling techniques and some different things like trip planning and things of that nature. And, it's open to the public.
Talk about the water quality assessment teams that you're looking at trying to put together, and just give us an overview of what the idea is there and where it stands and where it's going.
Sure. Well, Sierra Club has a grassroots network called Water Sentinels. And Water Sentinels is just kind of a very broad term, and how this program is applied in different areas depends upon that particular area. So a water sentinel group that would get started in some location, maybe to start off with, they deal with issues that are pretty recognizable and pretty easy to see, you know, by doing things like river sweeps or beach sweeps. Some of the groups will also take part in reviewing permits. And then you get into some water quality testing, which can be chemical, can be biological, site surveys. And I've been talking with Bob Goud about getting a Water Sentinels program started in South Carolina. And it's really early in its infancy at this point in time, but we're real excited about it. We feel that Sierra Club can make a big impact in our waters. You just don't see rivers like the Edisto anywhere, really. It's the longest free-flowing black water river in the country. And it's a river that is not only beautiful from a perspective of the wildlife, but also that it's a cultural and heritage thing as well. You know, a lot of the people who have been born and raised in the South, and in South Carolina in particular, going to the rivers, it was about commerce. It provided water to take care of their lands and their farming operations. And it was a place where they would escape to get away from the summer heat. And we feel that we need to have some more common sense legislation to protect these resources, particularly from the perspective that as our state's population continues to grow, we're going to run into more and more issues. The implications of the withdrawal out of the South Fork ESO is a scary proposition. The way that this would obviously impact the rivers at this point in time, Bob and I are going to get together in the coming week and try to discuss on what our thoughts are, what our goals are. You know, how do we get this started? How do we implement this? And so one of the things that we foresee is also we've got access to training for water testing. We have a Sierra Club member who's over in the Augusta, Georgia area, Frank Carl, who's the former river keeper for the Savannah River, who has he has offered to provide some testing for us, or some training for us on water quality testing. You know, so there'll be different things involved, like getting equipment together or working with some partners to use a lab services. It's all pretty new, but very exciting, because I think we can have play a major role in helping to keep our rivers clean. Working with a variety of different groups, I mean, like Wildlife Federation, you know, gosh, doing water tech quality stuff, that'd be something that's right up their alley. You know, American Rivers is another organization. Some of what they do is not only legislative, but actual projects, you know, on the ground, so to speak. So I think there's a lot of power in people partnering together to work towards a common cause.
Outstanding. And hoping that we'll be able to have you back on the Edisto TV podcast to update us on how things are going.
Great. I look forward to it.
Well, we do appreciate Chris coming on to the Edisto TV podcast with us. And as I said earlier, it is our intention now to check in with Chris fairly regularly, especially with the Water Sentinel program hopefully ramping up in the next few months. We'll keep you up to date on that, and hopefully we'll be participating on some level in that effort as well.
This is Tom from the Edisto TV podcast, and I just want to put in a word for Tyler Brothers. They've been serving the Blackwater region for over 100 years. Check them out at tylerbrothers.net, or if you're on Facebook, you definitely want to follow them and get the latest deals from them. You can find them at facebook.com/Tyler Bros. Tyler Brothers, since 1904, it's the place for you to be on a Saturday afternoon. They're open 8 to 6, 6 days a week, closed on Sunday. Stay away from the superstores and visit Tyler Brothers in Wagner.
Moving along, like I said earlier, we have these pieces that we haven't yet made it to air with of the interviews with Vince Furtick, Ben Gregg, and Bob Guild. So I'm going to edit those together so that we hear their perspectives on a variety of issues. And Tom, you were part of those interviews that we did with them. I can't think of three voices that, you know, can inform the conversation as much as these three.
Yeah, I mean, you got Vince, who's a farmer and who grew up on the river. So he's got, you know, I guess you could say like legitimate claim to the water in the river, but yet has a passion for protecting the river. And then you've got, you know, Ben and Bob, who've spent their life looking after rivers and natural resources. So, yeah, I think we should listen. I think legislators should listen to what these guys have to say as we're forming new legislation.
All right, so here we go. This is a pastiche, bringing together of various pieces from what they had to say, and the topic should be pretty self-explanatory as we go along.
A while back, I talked to the head of the Nature Conservancy here in South Carolina, and he had looked at how different states succeeded in passing strengthened water withdrawal laws, and he concluded that invariably it took several years, and it took the different interest to getting around the table and coming up with a compromise. I mean, water is a critical resource to everyone and to so many interests, vested interests in South Carolina. So we've got to have all the different parties sitting around the table, and we've got to have a process that leads to a compromise which is acceptable for everybody. It's not going to be perfect for anybody, but it needs to be acceptable to everybody. And then we need to have legislators that are saying this needs to happen, encouraging the folks sitting around the table to come up with a good solution. And then we've got to have legislators ready to take action. So ideally, this body would be set up by the legislature, and there would be a time frame by which the committee will go through a process, including public input, and come together and have a and have a compromise that's acceptable to everybody.
They're just like, they're not making any more land, they're not making any more rivers, and that river, and the river that I know, and in my opinion, all the rivers of our state belong to the people, and that means they don't belong to me, it doesn't belong to you, it belongs to all of us to share and to enjoy. It is far too valuable to put an economic price on that. I realize agriculture has changed. The small farmer has been pushed out. There are no more small farmers. I'm a small farmer with 150 acres of trees, but I don't farm a commodity like soybeans or corn or peanuts. You know, mine's a bit of a specialty crop, even though the green industry is the number three income-producing commodity in our state, behind turkeys and broilers, I believe. We're third, you know, and that takes into account greenhouses and all of that as well. You don't think of us being that large, but it is the third, you know, largest. But I'm still a small farmer. It doesn't take a very big footprint to do what I do. A 150-acre tree farm is a medium to large tree farm. 150-acre cotton farm is nothing. You know, it requires thousands of acres because there are economies of scale for a farmer to farm a commodity like corn, soybeans, cotton. So I understand that farming is getting bigger and that farms are getting larger as well. But there comes a point of diminishing returns where that is not very effective. And when you have to go and take a natural resource from the people of South Carolina in order for you to make a living, I feel that's breaking some of God's laws. That's just wrong. You know, when they passed this thing in 2010, they passed the Surface Water Withdrawal Act in 2010, they did not think that through. They saw dollar signs when they did that. They did not think about the consequences to our land and to our water, in my opinion. There is no common sense there. And as I understand, common sense is not very common anymore. But my feeling is that these rivers should not be touched. Leave them there for the people to enjoy. Not only the people, but if you destroy a river basin, you cannot rebuild a river basin. It's gone forever, and you cannot recreate that. That is an ecosystem that exists on its own that cannot be changed. It does not need to be tampered with in any way. There's been enough destruction to our rivers with the heavy metals and the things that have come down from the, you know, the chalk mines and the clay mines over around Aiken, which we didn't know any better back then. You know, back when in the early days, 60s, 70s, they didn't know as much before we had an EPA and a DHEC, and we actually understand the damage we can do. That damage can't be undone. You can't take the mercury out of the fish. You can't take the mercury out of the river. And the other heavy metals as well. It's there. So we have to live with that. But if we destroy it, if we damage it worse than it is now, we cannot undo that. So that's my feeling. We need to leave it alone.
Once the damage is done, it may not be repairable. You know, once you've sucked the river dry, restoring it is something that I don't think any of us want to contemplate. I mean, think about the Colorado system that once in an undammed, you know, major western river had ecological functions that will never be seen again. Imagine restoring that by persuading people to remove the dams and the reservoirs on the system and wean all of the agriculture in the Central Valley of California that now requires depends on their allocated withdrawal from the Colorado system. Las Vegas and whatever other cities in the desert we could point our finger at that depend on water. Imagine essentially turning the clock back and undoing the development patterns that depended on, poorly designed system for surface water withdrawal. Well, that would be the consequence if you say wait till the damage is done here. And fortunately, we've got enough historic evidence to save us from the necessity for learning the hard way. The Waller withdrawal was a wake-up call, and it's one that I think by mitigating it through the settlement, we've pointed toward the kinds of things that need to be included in any reform of the Surface Water Act and things that are missing from the Surface Water Act. I can only say that the law that was passed was certainly not something that that any of us understood could be applied the way it has. Most of us, myself included, weren't at the table reviewing the surface water law as it was proposed. So I can certainly say that Fred, didn't bless this this legislation with the notion that it would protect the Edisto system. And we certainly understand now, after the fact, that many of the best scientific minds, staff members at the South Carolina Department of Natural Resources, who are the stewards of the natural resources of our state, including the ecosystem of the rivers like the Edisto, and the best academic scientists who we trust to understand our water resources and their importance to South Carolina, they expressed strong reservations about the way the law was structured in terms of the so-called safe yield definition based on not low flows in the system, but based on these so-called mean flows in the river. And we've seen detailed scientific memos that these scientists from DNR and University of South Carolina and other institutions sent to members of the General Assembly at their request, expressing these reservations about the act as it was proposed. And those reservations were not addressed. So it's simply not fair to say that, one, we signed off on this law, or that, two, problems of this sort weren't identified early on, or that we haven't yet seen enough experience with the law to cause us to understand that it needs to be fixed. So the Waller settlement, in many ways, shows both the things that need to be fixed in the future and the things that that remain unaddressed. So, for example, you guys pointed earlier to the question of curtailment and the contingency plan, and under the law, that would be mandatory and it would be enforceable. Under the settlement with the Walters, they've committed to following that practice, but the law didn't require them to do that. Law doesn't require them to have a farm pond or backup irrigation wells. And if you're the next large industrial agricultural withdrawal registrant, the next shoe to drop, so to speak, you can thumb your nose at those requirements. You say, I don't have to have a backup a groundwater well or a farm pond or any curtailment requirement. You can also basically say that I don't have to even tell you how much water I'm withdrawing until the end of the year after I withdraw. That's the law requirement right now. So, for example, we'll only know at the end of a calendar year, I think in February when it's required, if I'm remembering right, when DEC gets a simple form back from the agricultural withdrawers saying, here's how much water I withdrew this year. And it's just really a month-by-month total withdrawal amount, which tells you nothing about, you know, how much water they were drawing on that summer day when the river is at its lowest point. As you know, the Waller settlement includes a requirement that they install a stream gauge at or near their withdrawal point that meets the design standards set by the U.S. Geological Survey that that operates the stream monitoring system for most of the streams stream gauges in the state. And as you know, those stream gauge stations are real-time gauges that are linked to a system that's posted on the U.S. Geological Survey's website. So I can go to the nearest stream gauge site for my property on the North Fork and see in 15-minute real-time increments what the gauge height is at a tributary flowing into the Edisto and what the flow rate is at that point. And that helps me and helps a number of users understand about the relative health of the river. We need more of those stations, but we need in particular to know what the river levels are on the South Fork Edisto near the Walder site, and you know we're watching with interest the implementation of that part of the Walder Farms commitment. Anyway, bottom line is I think what we understand is that there are a number of vulnerabilities in this law, and requiring agriculture to essentially play by the same rules as all other surface water withdrawal interests is just plain fair, and it's also the approach that has the best prospect of protecting all users, including the ecology of the river itself, as well as all those downstream property owners.
I thought that was pretty informative. I wonder what you made of what we just heard there, Tom.
Very informative. And I hope people take heed and we get lined up to make some changes to this law before the next session.
Absolutely. Something you and I have talked about a lot off mic, and that is going to, I think, be an increasingly prominent topic here on the podcast, is exactly what do we need to try to accomplish in changing the surface water withdrawal law, and also what is possible in terms of just political reality of getting something passed that we can all live with.
Right. And pretty much, I think most people believe that getting Farm Bureau on board is going to be a critical piece to that. And so just how willing they are to listen to reason and listen to the concerns of both farmers and non-farmers up and downstream, that's going to make a huge difference, because we can't do this. We can't make any changes, I don't think, without getting the ag lobby totally on board with some kind of compromise solution.
I think you're right there, and I don't pretend to have great insight into what happens behind the doors at the Farm Bureau, but my understanding is that it's this time of year, running up to the end of the year, when they are putting together their priorities and their legislative want list and those kind of things, leading into the next legislative session starting in January. So if we are going to be able to engage them and have a conversation about substantive issues related to changing the Surface Water Withdrawal Act, that needs to be happening through the summer and fall. So we look forward, hopefully, to having some positive developments to talk about on that front.
Yeah, and ironically, I know a lot of people who have concerns about the river quit Farm Bureau over the last 6, 9, 12 months because of their ridiculous stance on this issue. But I also have heard, for example, my good friend Doug, who has now joined Farm Bureau for, I think it's $35 just to join up and become a member, so that now he's on the mailing list and, you know, he can attend these meetings. But the idea is that Farm Bureau will be going around meeting with their members and getting their thoughts and input on their legislative agenda. So if you are a member of Farm Bureau, if you have access to these meetings, get out there and let them know you want change and you want it now.
Well said. And that wraps up episode 10 of the Edisto TV podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Any parting thoughts, Tom?
Have a nice day.
All right. Have a nice day from all of us here at the Edisto TV podcast, and we'll see you next week.
This is the Edisto TV podcast, produced by Edisto TV, connecting the Blackwater region.